everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. Today I'm speaking with Ursula Le Cour about The Devious Debutante, the third novel in a series set in 1880s New Orleans. Ursula Le Cour is the pen name of the mother-daughter writing team, Mary and Helen Scully. So in a first for New Books in Historical Fiction, I will be speaking with both of them together. The series begins in 1884, New Orleans' golden age, but all is not well in the city. Cost overruns and delays at the construction for the World's Industrial and Cotton Exposition seem to presage the Sochi Olympics and their potential for scandal, and rumors of embezzlement threaten to implicate the most prestigious families. By 1885, when The Devious Debutante opens, the exposition's problems have faded into insignificance next to the opium trade, which, thanks to a recent rise in import duties, has led to increased smuggling. But we don't discover that for a while. At the beginning, we meet Ben Merritt in the midst of an unexpected encounter. New Orleans, December 1885. Ben Merritt scanned the large Collins property. His eyes darted from left to right and back again. Was that? It was. A figure appeared in the garden to the left of the enormous stone house. Someone walking fast, actually running, in a skirt. Watching her race through a line of bushes and across the broad lawn toward the open front gate, he anticipated her path and turned just in time to catch the full brunt of her head and shoulders against his chest. He wrapped his arms around her as she fell backwards from the impact. Stunned, she wriggled free of his arms, sniffed and brushed her hair off her face, wiping her wet cheeks with the same motion. "I beg your pardon." Ben bowed and tipped his cap to the most beautiful young lady he'd ever seen. A governess, perhaps, to the young daughter of Patrick Collins? No, she couldn't be. A man with three sisters, he took in her blue wool coat, fashionably falling to the hips, unbuttoned to reveal the expensive fabric of her dress. The decorative braid, the jet beads, were far beyond the means of most employees. Perhaps an older cousin? He'd been told Patrick Collins had but one child, a daughter, 13 years of age. The young lady's head barely reached his shoulders, but she was lusciously proportioned. Not 13. And now, please join me in welcoming Ursula Le Cour. Hi, Mary and Helen. Thanks for agreeing to talk with me today.
Oh, we're delighted to be here.
Thank you for having us.
From your bios on your website, it seems fair to say that you've both been writers for a long time, but you came to writing historical romance by quite different paths. Mary, would you tell us your story, please?
Sure. Apparently, I've always been a storyteller because I used to walk around when I was about three with the phone book, and anybody who would listen to me, I'd sit down and tell them a story. So that's how I got started, but I've always, you know, been interested in reading and literature and so forth. And while raising my three children, I freelanced for the Virginian Pilot in Norfolk, Virginia. And from there, I got into doing their automotive section. And from there, I was an editor of a NASCAR racing magazine. So I've been sort of all over the book with what I write. But the real reason we got started with romance is my mother died of brain cancer. And Helen would, she lived in Mobile, and Helen would come over from New Orleans on weekends and so forth and help me out. And we were reading, you know, just all kinds of thrillers and stuff. And it just wasn't the right kind of reading matter when you were going through that. And we started reading romance, Amanda Quick, Eloisa James, Tessa Dare, where they all end happily, you know, no matter what the women are going through. And it's always the women who have the hardships. These books all end happily. And so it was a great reading for us. So after she died, we said, hey, let's try it. Let's write a book together. Make it happy.
That's great.
Anything you want to add to that, Helen?
Well, I'd like to hear Helen's story, too. So.
Yeah, I work in textbooks. I write and edit readers, you know, standalone readers for like middle school kids. So that's how I sort of, you know, survive financially while I write also. I had a literary novel come out in 2005 called In the Hope of Rising Again. And then I sort of switched over to trying to write these romances. And it's been really fun. It's been hard, but it's been fun too. And it's a nice it creates a nice balance with what I do in my day to day.
What is it that's hard about it for you, Helen?
Well, it's all hard. I think writing isn't easy. Coming from the literary world, I thought that this would be easy, and I was so wrong. It's just, you know, you really have to feel your characters. You have to get the plot right. You've got the historical research. There's so much that goes into it, and there's that extra degree of just love and care to create something that's, you know, whole and beautiful. It's just, it's hard. There's no way around it.
So you're the first couple, joint authors whom I've talked to. I'm really interested in how the two of you work together, how, you know, what your actual writing process is, how you come up with a story.
All right. Well, we start with some sort of an outline. We are definitely pantsers, though, and not somebody who sits down and strictly goes through that, you know, by chapter three, such and such has to happen. We just actually were driving in a car from Mobile to New Orleans one day and said, hey, let's get on that novel that we've been talking about. And so we, at that point, came up with our characters, our French milliner, our Irishman who's just come to town, and then the other secondary characters and all just developed as we started writing. And we didn't really have a plot, did we, Helen? I mean, we started that first page. I don't think we did. We just said, we're going to set it in her shop, and I think you wrote the first chapter about the shop, or I did,
I really don't remember. It's been, and it's what worked for us, especially with the first book, was that I was the man and she was the woman. So we sort of knew what, you know, they had to react to each other. So she'd send me a chapter and I would write the alternating chapter from his point of view.
And yeah, we would just keep going back and forth like that.
Oh, yeah. That's really interesting. So in that sense, it's a real benefit to have two people working together because you can stay identified with one character.
Well, right.
Exactly.
And it was exciting because I remember particularly, you know, I had done Renee and she had reacted when William came in the shop. She thought he was very handsome and all this stuff. And then the next chapter, Helen writes it from his point of view. And he has had a terrible situation with a woman jilting him. They had been courting each other for two or three years, and suddenly they were going to elope, and she never shows up. And so he's very bitter about women and love and everything. I didn't know any of that about him. You know, that was just, so I thought, hey, this is fantastic. So now we've got a whole other dimension here. And I'm sure some similar things where I would put in something that had happened to Renee that in her past that Helen didn't know.
Oh,
so it's
absolutely.
Just all those backstories that, you know, normal couples, real couples have to learn about each other. We had as the writers to learn about those things.
That's such a fascinating thing. Yes. I mean, I'm very much a pantser too, so I totally relate. I mean, I actually try to make up outlines, and by the time I've written about five pages, something has occurred to me and I've gone off and, you know.
Yes, yeah. That's the way it's fun, is you go off into something that you had never thought about at the beginning. But it worked really well for us. And we would, you know, we might revise a chapter four or five times or maybe even more than that before we would go on. You know, so it would be like, okay, we both agree chapter one is pretty much finished and then chapter two and go along chronologically as the story unfolded.
Well, I have to say, in the editing process, it was we just edited so many times, probably, I don't know, 10 times to the point where it became, you know, that we had both written it all. You know, I knew that I had started off with the man, but I by the end, it was so blended, I hope, successfully blended that, you know, it was the same. We were the same writer at that point.
Well, I have to tell you that it was news to me that you had started off in different places. I mean, it really does read seamlessly. And that's why I was so fascinated as to how you put it together, because it didn't seem as if two separate people had written it.
Right.
Well, thanks. We appreciate that.
Yeah.
And then as far as the sex scenes and stuff and people saying, how do you do that with your mother? The way that happened, too, was just with the flow of the book. If it came to a point where one of us felt it was really time to have some sort of intimate encounter, that person would just write it and send it to the other one and say, what do you think of this? This seemed like a good place to have this happen. And so, you know, we weren't sitting there line by line describing where his hands were and where hers were and all that sort of stuff. It just kind of evolved that if something was really obnoxious to one of us, we would cut that or, you know, add something if we felt it was important. So that we
and
flowed.
Sorry, Mom. We knew that we needed these scenes too. We were very pragmatic about it. That you know, this is a romance, and we want these to be, you know, exciting scenes, and they need to happen at this place and this place and this place. So we inserted them in, and then if like you're saying, if something was just like odd, it got cut. But otherwise, we just respected each other and you know, let it go, especially when it was good.
Is this the way that you normally start? Do you normally start with the characters, or was it unique to that book, that first book?
Oh, I think we start with the characters, yeah, before the plot, because like I say, the plot just kind of goes along as things happen, and I don't know why they happen. They're just in one of our brains, and like in The Devious Debutante, where that woman, Suzette, is being abused by her horrible husband.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know where that came from. I was writing Suzette, and, you know, suddenly I have her husband beating her, you know. So then we had to, then that led to other parts of the plot. So it just, you know, I don't know. It's magic. I don't know. It just seems to work out, though.
I think with a romance, you really do have to start with the characters, don't you? I mean, first off, plot really grows out of character anyway. It's what people do, and that's very specific to who they are. But especially in a romance, if you can't connect to the characters, it's kind of like, what's the point?
Right, exactly right.
So let's talk a little bit about the series, since you've set it up so nicely. Helen lives in New Orleans now, and Mary lived there for a while. Is that why you chose to set the series there? I mean, there must be something specific about the city that drew you to writing about it.
My mother's entire family's from Mobile, but before they lived in Mobile, they lived in New Orleans. So I live here, and my mother and father lived here also for 9 years. They're now in Philadelphia, but they lived here, and I lived here with them, and my brother and sister. We all live here, and we all you know, spend a lot of time in Mobile. So it was just a natural thing. And then we wanted an American setting. We just got a little tired of the Dukes, you know, and we thought, now, can't we come up with a way to, you know, make this just as compelling set in America? So we chose the Gilded Age because there was a lot of, you know, enormous wealth. And then we chose New Orleans because this is a romantic city, and we had lived through Katrina, and we thought, you know, let's shine some light on this beautiful town.
Because it really is very unusual for an American city. You know, it has a more European flavor, and so that's exciting and just beauty. And I think it was just a perfect thing. And we chose the date because we wanted to be well past the Civil War. We did not want to write about any of that misery. And so that worked perfectly that we got into the 80s. Which is a very exciting time worldwide. You know, you've got Queen Victoria on the throne. You've got all kinds of inventions. You've got the change from agriculture to industrialization. There's just a lot of going on everywhere.
And there's a lot going on in the United States as well. I mean, this is really when the business society gets going, is in the 1880s.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And the robber barons and things were really, it is a huge change. And so that's one reason we feel, too, we can keep going with these. You know, we can get into, like, the bicycle was invented, so we've got that. And we can get into cars, even if we keep going into the 90s. And the...
Well, and it's interesting, too. Our heroes are businessmen. I mean, the first William in The Wailing Widow is a cotton factor, essentially, you know, just a tradesman. Not a tradesman, but, I mean, he's basically in the stock market for cotton. And then the other guy, Ben Merritt, in the second book is a lawyer. And then we've got a journalist in the third book. So it gives us a chance to really get into, you know, the city and the world at large through the men and the women.
And also women, of course, at that time are getting more and more independent and willing to do all sorts of things and try to go into work for themselves, shops, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, so let's talk about your characters, because I think I should explain to people, if I haven't already said this in my introduction, that all of these characters are connected. It's like you're creating a world and you focus on one set of characters and then another set of characters. So the very first book is called The Wailing Widow, and you're going to have to correct my pronunciation because I'm never quite sure whether New Orleans uses a true French pronunciation or whether it's, it's more Americanized. But so I would say Renée de Sel, but... I don't know.
That's what we call her, yeah, Renée de Sel.
So she's the heroine of the first book. She's not really a willing widow. People just think she is.
Right.
So tell us about her. You mentioned a little bit about William, but what is Renée's story?
You want to do that one, Helen?
Yeah. Well,
I guess I should, because I wrote about her. Yeah, she was an artist. She was an artist her whole life. She was always fascinated by... drawing and painting, and she loved clothes. She's an only child, a daughter, and her mother dressed her impeccably because it's a very rich family. And so she grew up wanting to do that. And then her mother died. She was sent off to an aunt in Atlanta to raise her for 3 or 4 years, and then she came back. I'm getting mixed up with Devious Debutante, who went to Atlanta. Anyway, Renée is married to this much older man. This is just after the war. She marries him, and I don't want to go into what happens in their marriage. But
no, don't tell us that.
She's now a widow, and so she starts sketching hats and selling her designs, making them up herself and selling them to some of the wealthy families. And she's, she is... not on the highest level like the Collins family is. They know each other, but they don't really socialize much. They wouldn't really have dinner together. And but she Maureen Collins is one of her best customers. And so they do get to know each other, and they'll gossip together and so forth. But Renée is just hell-bent on making a success of her shop. And being a single woman, she does not think of having another marriage. When she meets William, she's not interested in that at that moment.
And you've already told us a little bit about William, but what kind of person is he? Helen, you want to take that one?
Sure. I know. I'm just thinking about him because I feel like I know him so well. He's a good man. I don't know. You know, how else to say that except that, you know, he's sensitive. He's very sensitive, and he's kind, and he's smart, and he's just, part of the drama in the book is that Renée and William, they just misunderstand each other, and that's partly because they're both such sensitive people. They're just both good people, and in some of these romances, they all have flaws, and he does. He's insecure, frankly. He was jilted, so he's bringing that kind of just sore heart to the equation, and so he misreads things from her, and she does too. But generally, he's out and about and trying to I don't know, seek justice, I guess, because another part of the drama is this embezzling that's going on at the Cotton Exposition, and then he's also watching out for his cousin, who's a bit reckless, so he's on the town trying to make things right, and then he finds this woman he loves, and he tries to make that right.
I'm glad you mentioned the Cotton Exposition, because I was going to get to that next. I mean, even though this is a romance and the relationship between William and Renee is most important, it's a historical novel. So there's this wonderful background with the World's Industrial and Continental Exposition. It's the kind of thing that you have to say five times fast as a tongue twister. But it's a real... I mean, your story is a story, but this is a real event, right? How did you find out about
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. It was a real event. We were just, what we did was once we decided we wanted to write about New Orleans and approximately the date, you know, late 1800s, then we just sort of tried to read on the internet and in books, just things, what was really happening in New Orleans at that period. And this thing just popped out. Some article I was reading about this great exposition. Cities around the world were having these expositions.
Well, it was
show
like
a
World's Fair.
Like a World's Fair where you would show off maybe fine things, cultural art things that your country did, but you would also show off, you know, the newest sewing machine that you made in your country. So people were showing all sorts of things just to give themselves publicity. And this thing, Uncle Patrick, who is William's uncle and Maureen's father, if that's confusing, he's on the committee. There was a local committee of people appointed by the governors who were supposed to run this thing. But there was just craziness. The chairman of the committee actually ran off with more than $1 million, which was a huge amount of money in those days. And so there were construction delays. Helen can tell about, she called her accountant and said, "How would I embezzle money from a company if I wanted to?"
All these great writer questions, right? How would I poison somebody?
Oh, we had great fun talking about it. I mean, basically, he gave us the idea of making up those ghost employees. The Cotton Exposition was a real big deal, and I think it adds to showing, you know, kind of where the city was and where the country was at the time.
I have to tell you, I was reminded of the Sochi Olympics when I was reading this book.
Yes, you are right, exactly.
All the cost overruns.
Cost overruns, things didn't work, and it was in this part of New Orleans that's now Tulane University and Loyola University, and some beautiful housing around there in the university area, they call it. But it was mud. Basically, it was 8,000 acres or something of mud when they started building, and they didn't get very far. You know, but that was one of the things. Once we found out about that, we went to, there's a special archives, I think it's called the Williams Research Center.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. Yeah, it's the Historic New Orleans Collection, the Williams Research Center. Go ahead.
Which is just which I think is a private library, essentially, but I mean, they let anybody use it. They had drawings of this thing, the way it was supposed to look. They had photographs of it when it opened. I mean, there was a lot of real stuff there that was available to us. So we went over there, and you would just ask them what you wanted, and they would go get it from their special file cabinets and everything and bring it to your table, and you could read all day. So we did a lot of research on stuff like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, all that stuff is true. We didn't make that up about the, you know, the Mexican Pavilion, and there was a lot of, they were obviously trying to make ties with trade ties with South America, because a lot of South American and Central American countries were represented at this fair. Well, with all sorts of, you know, exhibits, grasses and cows and whatever else.
But it also made for a great way to wrap a story a little bit around that, because of course William was trying to, he would go to the fair and look and see what they'd done, and he would come back and tell his uncle who was on the committee that, hey, you know, they're not doing anything, nothing's really happening, it's never going to be ready for the opening day. And so it made him sort of a hero in addition to what he was doing, just learning the cotton trade.
He becomes a savior. Yeah,
he does. And it's, I mean, this is what I love about history. It really opens up possibilities that you hadn't considered before you started.
That's right. That's right. And then we also read about, I think it was it cholera, Helen, or yellow fever? Yellow fever.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was 1878 or something was the worst one. And so we, that enabled us to kill Renee's father
and husband.
And Aunt Sophie's
and first husband.
And first husband. So we got rid of a lot of characters who had some insight. I mean, you know, they were part of the story, but we didn't want them hanging around. We wanted Renee to be single because that made her this strong new woman who was running her own business.
And was it at this archive, too, that you did research about the Red Light District, where William spends a fair amount of time while he's investigating this situation with the
cotton? Oh, yeah, we did. We saw pictures of that street, and then we read about it. There weren't a lot of photographs, and they've torn it down. Or, you know, somebody swept through there and just leveled it to try to end the scourge of debauchery. But we did read a lot about it, and there was this, as a port town, it's New Orleans has always had that kind of entertainment zone for you know, gambling, prostitutes, dance halls, all that.
Exactly.
Yeah,
poker,
so that
and the cocktail was supposedly invented in New Orleans.
Yeah,
the game of poker. So yeah, there was definitely this part of town that wasn't where he shouldn't have been, or, you know, she's scandalized when she hears that he goes there almost every night. She's very upset because she doesn't think he's that kind of person.
And she's right. So,
and she's right.
So we're going to move on now so that people are intrigued by the novel without knowing too much about what happens. I mean, I'm sure they can guess where the romance goes, but the rest of it is a story unto itself. And we're going to talk about the next part, which is a novella called A Christmas Kiss. And at the end of The Willing Widow, you mention that these two, Michel Datois and Auguste Faber, needed their own story. Why did they need their own story?
Can you answer that, Helen?
Yeah, I can, because I made up Faber, and we meet him in The Willing Widow. He works alongside William. He's just an interesting character. He's a Creole, and he has ties to the voodoo world through his cousin Gustav. So he plays a significant enough role in The Willing Widow. And then I just liked him. I thought he was kind of a funny guy. And Michelle also she's Renee's shop assistant, and she's also a very talented artist and hat maker. And so we thought, well, they'll be from the same town upriver. And I should say that they have, the reason we were thinking of both of those characters too was that they have these Christmas bonfires along the Mississippi River upriver from New Orleans, and we knew it wanted to be Christmas, and so we decided to set it there with both of them and their backstory.
Yeah, yes. This is one of the things that I particularly enjoyed is in the story. I mean, we didn't talk about the voodoo in The Willing Widow, in part because I think it's kind of foreign to the story, but there is this real sense of New Orleans culture with the voodoo and with the bonfires, and then there's Mardi Gras in the Divas Debutantes, which we'll get to in a minute. But the other thing that I really liked in this story is the bicycles, the velocipedes, as they call them then. What made you decide to include that? It's a great element in the story.
Well, because again, when we were reading about that period of time, and we've got old photos of New Orleans, you know, that we've seen that have been printed in books, the bicycle had really been before the Civil War that were riding them around, but men weren't. I mean, women weren't ever riding bikes. And so this Gaston, who's a cousin of Fabre's, he decides that he could make money if he made a little trail and try to teach women to ride bikes. And all the physicians of the time were against it. They said it would cause something called bicycle face, where you'd be riding along and you'd lose control of your bike and you would make this horrible face that would freeze that way and never go away.
Didn't your mother used to tell you that when you were a little kid? You know, if the wind changes, your face will stay that like
that. Oh, I certainly heard that from my grandmothers, that if you made a weird frown or did something, your face would stay that way. So that's what the physicians were telling women, that they shouldn't be biking. But Gaston gets the idea that he can charge people to do these bike rides, and he does. And that's when one of them runs into Fabre.
And these are regular bikes, right? These are not the ones that have enormous front wheels, the penny farthing.
Oh, no. They had, by this time, they had, I think, what was called a safety bike, and the wheels were the same size, and you had a brake, and you know, it should have been pretty easy to ride. But apparently it wasn't always. In the women's clothes, you know, they would wear bloomers or they would wear some sort of split
skirt.
That's
very shocking. That's very shocking.
Yeah. So it was, that part was really fun. And it just gave us one thing. We have a picture of my grandmother at 8 years old, and I think she was born in 81, on her bike. And she's got on a long dress to her ankles, but she's sitting on the bike, you know, smiling, you know, happy as she could be. And she had brothers who I'm sure got bikes first, and so she was delighted to get her own bike.
That's great.
So
one of the things about Michelle and Auguste is that they're of different social classes, right? This is the main impediment for them, because it is a shorter story, so there isn't a whole depth in the longer one.
Yeah, and that one was a little tricky for us. What we started with her being really poor, and then we gradually, I think, didn't we, Helen, give her a little more money? Or, you know, she was selling. Fabre was a hunter. He would get muskrat and the different things, a fur trapper, and give her those, and she would decorate a coat or something with the fur and sell it to some of the women along the river who were wealthier.
I think in terms of class that, you know, we really have tried to examine class in our books and make people mobile a little bit. Again, just that speaks to America. In her case, she's like Renee. She's a woman who's figured out how to make extra money. And I also think in the country, you know, as opposed to the city, there's just their neighbors anyway. So, yes, they're different social classes, but they know each other well, you know. So we needed to breach that divide.
And they fall in love and, you know, and they plan to go to New Orleans.
Yeah.
To make
right. Yeah, they do that in the beginning. I mean, they're already in love at the beginning, and then things go wrong in ways that we won't mention that.
We'll talk about,
No, it's a really nice short story, and it's cute. It's got this lovely Christmas stuff at the end. So, that's the one that's only on ebook, so people need to look for it.
That's correct.
Right. So this brings us to The Devious Debutante, which is book 3, which is what we're focusing on only because it's the most recent. And this is new books in historical fiction, although none of them are very old. And it is the story of Maureen Collins, whom we've already mentioned, and Ben Merritt, whom you identified as a lawyer, and the illicit trade in opium, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. Maureen is indeed, as Ben discovers not long after the opening passage that I read, not 13. Tell us about her. Who is she beyond being the daughter of Patrick Collins?
Again, she is a very independent woman, always has been independent and said what she thinks, and her father has totally indulged her, so she's always had her way. And even when she did crazy things, he would forgive her, you know, and say, well, okay, it's all right. When she goes off to Vespasian as a friend of hers, she's known all her life, and their mothers were very close friends, Vespasian's and Maureen's. She spends a night with Vespasian one night. Highly, you know, I don't know what the word is. But anyway, she tells him that tells her father that nothing happened, that they shared a bottle of wine and that was it.
Which is itself pretty scandalous for 1884 or whatever this is.
Yes, yeah. It's very scandalous. But he says, well, okay, just don't do it again, sort of thing. And so that's what she's becoming. Vespasian does drink a lot, and she's a little bored with that. So when she meets Ben, she's fascinated by him.
And who is Ben? I mean, he's a Yankee. He's come down from, is it Philadelphia?
That's right.
What is he doing in New Orleans?
Go ahead with that one, too.
Okay, well, he has graduated from Columbia Law School and specializing in maritime law and really international trade. And so New Orleans is an obvious place for that. But in addition to that, Ben's father is a friend of the current Secretary of the Department of Treasury for the U.S. government. And at that time, any kind of money trade stuff was under the Treasury Department. I don't know if it still is, but the way it read when I was reading about it, it sounded like it's not anymore. But at that time, they were important. They had people that they hired trying to catch smugglers. And the opium smuggling thing started because opium was legal in the United States, and everybody who wanted it, I mean, they claim you could buy it like we buy aspirin today. I mean, pharmacies had laudanum and they, you know, just sold that over the counter. And it was after the Civil War. At some point, the Treasury Department decided they needed to raise the tariffs on opium coming into the country because they still had Civil War debt to pay. So they raised it an enormous amount, something like, I can't quote the exact thing to you right now, something like from $5 a pound or something to $10 a pound. It was a huge. And so at that point, the people
smuggling
started smuggling.
Yeah, they wanted to avoid the tariff. So it basically just, the smuggling became rampant. And the three ports where where the opium was coming in illegally were San Francisco, New Orleans, and New York. So we know
that's absolute truth. And we were, you know, so we just put Merritt, the Treasury Secretary, says, look, would you do me a favor? We'll manage to get you a job with a good law firm there. We'll place you somewhere, and we want you to explore the smuggling that's going on. So he's working like a dog during the day.
Right, yeah. And they're losing a lot of money, the government is. That's why it was worth their time to send investigators down.
So we read all about tariffs. Just, you know, and these things, like, it would develop and we'd have to go explore that. Because we really were priding ourselves on getting this all historically accurate.
Well, yeah, we left no stone unturned when we got to something like the tariffs. I mean, I don't think I even knew what a tariff really was. I had a general idea, but just, we really dug in.
Well, I have to say I admire that, because if I had to research tariffs, I think I would find a different topic. It's sort of
It's not all exciting, but...
I was going to say, cotton, grades of cotton isn't that exciting either, but...
That is true. That is true. What you guys do for your art, right?
Helen learned for... she read books on cotton, the kinds of cotton there.
The
you know, what kind
of
strands of cotton.
Right, I remember that. William has to learn all of that in the first book, right?
Yeah,
right.
That's right. So... you know, but all that is a lot of fun because we just both like history anyway, and reading historical stuff, and it really drives me crazy when a Regency romance will have nothing in it except one scene where the woman gets in a carriage, and the rest of it you wouldn't know you were in, the way they live. And mm-hmm. I think that's just, that's not right. If you're going to write a historical book, you need to be accurate about things and what's going on, what people are worried about, thinking about.
Well, you really do. And it also, it's really, people didn't have the same, they weren't living under the same conditions. And so they didn't react the same way that a modern person does. So you really lose a lot if you don't put a little effort into figuring out into the context, because, as I was mentioning before too, it opens up so many possibilities because, when did they first get a police force? 1810, something like that. I mean, before then it was a very different world and people had to, you didn't travel alone and you had to go armed. I mean, it opens up a lot of things that you wouldn't think about. People can't call on the telephone, right? They have to write a letter. Right? I mean, it's
no emails.
Well, exactly. Messengers are running around town.
And that changes people's expectations of when you're going to get news about something or, what happened before there were newspapers, right? I mean, it does a disservice not only to your reader, but even to your story, not to think about all of those things.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
So, we have to kind of fudge a little bit. I mean, partly why we chose this time is that, the women are testing the boundaries now. So exactly what you mentioned before, the idea that Maureen Collins would spend the night with this man and then say nothing happened. So we had to find reasons why the women would, be overwhelmed with love so that it would defy convention.
Mm-hmm. They were willing to defy convention because the love was so strong.
Right.
Yeah. And the one thing I know you wanted to ask about was, were there that many arranged marriages? And that is something I was reading yesterday to try to find that out. We have a book on Victorian America. I don't think it's easy to really research because you don't know, there are not going to be statistics on these people were in arranged marriages and so many thousands weren't,
Right.
I think since the class distinctions were pretty important, that Maureen would be sort of scheduled to marry this Vespasian Colville because they had grown up together, their families were friends, all of that. They were the same social class. And whereas, Ben Merritt, like you say, he's a Yankee. The father keeps saying that, well, he's a Yankee and he's suspicious of him. So,
And he's not Catholic, right? I mean, that's another big element in our books is that, sort of the magistry and the pageantry of the Catholic faith, especially then, because New Orleans was a predominantly Catholic city just because we'd been governed by the French and the Spanish. And then, any of the sort of people from the Caribbean that came up would have been Spanish, So that is something that we enjoy kind of playing with that because it was a big part of the culture.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are not arranged marriages in the same sense as the ones in my book where people literally do not meet until, it's like that marriage at first sight thing where they literally meet like an hour before they're about to be betrothed.
Wow.
But they are more to, I think the kind of arranged marriage that was more typical of the 18th or 19th century where you get, where what you really have are these wealthy families that are trying to protect their property. And so, they're
marrying,
all intermarried. So these are people who know each other. They just may not be romantically involved because they're still not. I think by 1880s, people were starting to get more attached to the idea of romance, but probably still not in the big families. And certainly, even under the Regency, marriage was not really about love. It was about social status and for the woman, social
and
protection and property.
Mm-hmm. And property, and families sharing property or gaining property,
So I'm glad that you answered that one, because you mentioned Vespasian earlier, and I wasn't sure if we should get back to him. But this is really also in part about the power of parents still in the late 19th century. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really about Maureen's, I guess we'd say Maureen's relationship with her father, but I have the sense that it's more to do with the fact that her mother is dead, and so he's kind of at a loss because, you know, men didn't really do a lot of child, they didn't do a lot of child care in that period, and I think he, I always had the impression that he was kind of wishing her mother were here to handle it, you know?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, he's a little in up, and she takes advantage of that, of course.
Yeah, she does. So you couldn't explain why she's called the devious debutante, because she...
Right, exactly.
Well, she's impetuous, and she's always been that way. I mean, she was that way in The Willing Widow, so that's just part of her character. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she's just going to...
But
jump.
She's always
she's gonna do what
out.
She wants.
Yeah, she's always sneaking out, saying she's going to be looking after her plants, and then she's out the street. And this is how how she gets involved peripherally in the opium smuggling, which is a lot of fun. I don't know how much she wanted to say about that, because obviously you don't want to take it too far. But, I mean, at one point she actually witnesses a murder, which is a very traumatic thing.
Yeah, that was
thing.
Scary. And we did read about grafting camellias to this, a book that was written in 1880 called Practical Camellia Culture. And we read a lot of that because it has had all the prices. I think, you know, you could buy some varieties of camellias for maybe 50 cents a piece. So when this guy says $5 or $10 or whatever he wanted Ben to pay for a camellia, he knew that that was an absurd price. He didn't know much about flowers, but he knew that was ridiculous. But he pays it anyway because he wants to give her something fancy.
Yes, we should mention that Maureen is really knowledgeable at plants and very involved in plants. She has her own greenhouse, which is a gift from her father. She would love to sell plants, but her dad's having none of that because she's a girl. But this is really how the story gets going, and it's fairly early on, is that Ben gives her this fancy camellia, which turns out to have what the seller calls fragrant roots.
Which is his just name for it, because he can't tell him what's in the fragrant roots, so he just makes that up, you know, and it takes Ben a while to figure it out.
So they put a tin of opium in the roots, which is and then it becomes a kind of code word, you know, that Ben can use.
Yes, exactly. But it really was fascinating, too, just reading about some of the things they did. You know, they would put opium in tin cans and then drop them off the coast somewhere, and somebody else would come up in a little rowboat or something and dive for the tins of opium. I mean, they knew they were watching them, but they kept coming up with strange ways to get them in and out of the country.
Well, and there must have been, I mean, we know that there were legal opium dens in New Orleans, and that we even found an article from that time period of, you know, the scourge of opium. And there were addicts, you know, already in town. And,
those people were paying legitimate... They're paying legitimate taxes on it. They're buying it, and they're
addicted to it. Yeah, and so I mean, it's kind of something that doesn't always get talked about that time period, that, you know, that stuff was available and people were taking it.
And a lot of it. Now, we didn't really go into that because we don't have any Maureen, you know, taking opium or something, but apparently women were some of the big addicts.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah, and I was going to say, she worries that Ben is an addict, and women were.
Yeah.
I mean, I read that kind of recently, that, you know, all those women that were just, you read about them in books where they were just, like, kind of ill, or they had, like, a nervous condition, and they, you know, they went days without staying in their room and stuff, or, you know, days without coming out of their rooms, that they were just high on laudanum or something. You know, and that they did use it for nerves, and they used it for dealing with the transition into the modern age.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's definitely true. I mean, it was a very common medication, and there were also all those I don't want to say prescription medications, because it's actually the kinds of things that shysters were selling at fairs, you know, all these medicines that were basically alcohol.
Oh, right, the
right?
Patent medicines.
Yeah.
Patent medicines, yeah. Yes, thank you. So what would you like readers to take away from this series?
Yeah, what was that question?
What would you like readers to take away from your series?
I'd like them to enjoy it and be happy, you know, to just enjoy getting into the family and the New Orleans atmosphere and all of that. And they all have happy endings. So, you know, it's going to be good when you finish. You're going to be happy. And that's what I want women to have.
I'd like them to just join us. And we've had such fun and joy in creating the series. And, you know, just spreading the love of New Orleans and just the different families. And one of my favorite things about this series is that, you know, you see people again and again. You're going to finish with Renee in book one, but she's going to appear and, you know, reappear. And it's just, it's kind of nice. I really love the world we've created. And I'd like people to enjoy it.
Yeah, it's joy.
Now, you're still, you have a book four, which is mentioned at the end of book three. Is it still called When a Lady Loves?
No, that was, we've changed every title after we've put them in the next book before.
Yeah.
This next one is called The Perfect Partner. And that is the one about Vespasian. He is going to be reformed. And that was a little hard to do because he was pretty wild, but, He's going to be a good guy in this next one, and that should be out soon.
Yeah.
And I actually messed that up because When a Lady Loves was the original title of the Divi's Debutante. So, had another title, and now it's The Perfect Partner. That's good to know.
Mm-hmm.
And is that one ready to come out, or are you already working on a fifth one?
We're working on the The Perfect Partner. In fact, it's completely written, and it's with our agent right now. And she'll be looking it over and deciding what to do with it. But the next one is going to be about an earl or duke or somebody who's inherited his father's property, and it's going to rack and ruin because that's what was happening in England in that period of time. They couldn't afford to keep their farms. Agriculture was suffering. So he comes to New Orleans looking for a rich bride. And he is,
which is common again. That was common by that point. That you know, that the Americans had all the money.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was very.
They
common,
were marrying
yes.
for titles. You know, they wanted to be duchess. And so their rich families, their fathers who were running railroads or something and had more money than they knew what to do with, would marry off the daughter for however many pounds. And she'd get the title. So this is what this man is trying to do, is meet a rich woman in New Orleans. And he ends
He meets his match.
I'm not going to tell you who he falls in love with. But
I have to say, we're also working on this. It's called A Carnival Kiss. So it's going to be a novella that blends with A Christmas Kiss. Or, you know, mirrors A Christmas Kiss, but around carnival. And it's a prostitute and a gentleman who's just hit the streets the night before Mardi Gras, and all sorts of things happen.
Well, that sounds great. All right. Well, now that I've figured out how to talk to two people at the same time.
Oh, yeah, this is good.
It works well.
We'll have you back and talk about the English Earl and the the Carnival Kiss and the rest. And
we'd love it. We'd love it.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. It's been really fun.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, and today I've been speaking with Ursula Le Cœur about The Devious Debutante and the series of which it is a part. You can find out more about these novels at www.ursulalecoeur.com. Like us on Facebook, search for Indie Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at newbookshistwic. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can also find out more about me, my website, and my books at blog.cpleslie.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about new books in historical fiction.